what if we just make practicing fun, right? What if they just want to practice? If they are curious, and if I can just get them to enjoy the process itself, won't the result come eventually? And so that was what sort of led me into this topic, getting students to become sort of perpetual motivation machines, that they embrace the process, not necessarily the product, and that they go to the piano naturally, and that the art of practicing and improving is its own reward in a way.
Welcome to the Piano Sensei Way. I am your host, Clinton Pratt, and I'm here to help you master the art of running a successful piano teaching studio. I'm here today with Evan Mitchell, and I'm excited to talk to him because I met him at an MTNA conference and went to his session, and it was so great, and I've been wanting to have him on ever since. So welcome, Evan, and tell everybody where you are and who or what you teach.
Thank you. It's good to be with you. Good to see you again. So I'm in my studio in Gainesville, Florida. I teach at the University of Florida. Have a piano studio of major undergraduate and graduate students. I've taught at times a large private studio, all ages and stages, group piano, kind of a little bit of everything. We actually met at a TMTA conference. I think we were on the Independent Music Teachers Forum panel together.
Oh, right.
That was where we first met.
Yes.
A few years back. I was mostly private teaching then. I was at a two-year college and have since moved into academia full-time, have a handful of private students. But this is where I do my work, and that's sort of the nature of it, mostly advanced college-level pianists at this point.
Okay. Yeah, great. And I know you perform as well. I just saw that you did Rachmaninoff second. Is that right?
Yeah. So I got back just last night, one of a good number of concert trips back to Texas, where I still have a lot of connections and close friends and colleagues and get to play a lot. So that was the Saturday night.
Wow. Okay. Yeah, I would have loved to hear it for two reasons. One, I love that piece. Of course, who doesn't? I played the first movement in a concerto competition in grad school, but I didn't win or anything. And then the second reason is you're actually an amazing pianist. I heard you play even just in sessions where you're demonstrating pieces.
Oh, thanks.
And yeah, so great. So I wish I would have heard you. Did you record it, or are you doing recordings?
I don't know if they did this time. Wasn't. I know there wasn't a stream. I guess I'll find out if it pops up somewhere. There's a recording.
Okay, so our topic is motivation, and we could have multiple episodes on this, I'm sure. It's a huge topic, and I was going to say controversial, but I mean, of course, everybody believes in motivation, so, but controversial in the fact of how it works, how should we do it? We got extrinsic motivation, intrinsic, our job as a teacher. Are we supposed to stimulate motivation? Should it be from the students? Should it be from the parents? All these sort of things. So where would you like to start?
Yeah, I mean, the notion that there's anything controversial about it, we all agree this is, students need to be motivated in order to practice, to get better. Looking at some of the social, scientific, and behavioral psychological research and how we can apply that to developing intrinsic motivation, getting students to become sort of perpetual motivation machines, that they embrace the process, not necessarily the product, and that they go to the piano naturally, and that the art of practicing and improving is its own reward in a way. So we'll get to talking about rewards for sure. I'll preface this with what led me to it, I guess. And that, at least in large part, was becoming a parent and signing our son, who's six now, up for preschool. And for a few years, we had him in Montessori preschools, and reading the parent guidelines handbook for one of these preschools, something to do with the children will, they enjoy the process, not the result. So they don't understand at that age, you know, we have 3 minutes or you're going to be late for something, or daddy's going to be late for something, get your shoes tied, you know, figure out what you're going to wear, put that last snack in your mouth and get in the car. They understand how, you know, strap this Velcro piece onto the other part of your shoe, and now do this, and now do this, step by step. And it just struck me, like, I wasn't teaching any students quite that young at that time, you know, 3, 2. But even in older children and to some degree adolescents and adult students, the kind of convincing that I would find myself resorting to, you know, well, look, if you practice this way, you're going to develop this good habit over time. And the corollary, you know, if you keep doing this or that, if your nails are long, and right, you're going to develop this habit over time. They can't project that far into the future, right? Even if they are older and have the wherewithal, you know, as adolescents or adults, they haven't been through the process of practicing or learning that many pieces that they understand what any of that means, what it means to get 3 months into a piece with poor habits, or what it means to level up through a number of repertoire pieces and develop their artistry in a certain way. So from that whole paradigm of explain where this is going to get the student and convince a seven-year-old to do this or that, right? I started thinking about, well, what if we just make practicing fun, right? What if they just want to practice? If they are curious, and if I can just get them to enjoy the process itself, won't the result come eventually? And so that was what sort of led me into this topic.
Right. And I'm thinking about when I was a child and I liked coloring, and yeah, the outcome, I didn't really care about it. I wasn't that good. I didn't want to hang it on the fridge or anything, but I liked just sitting down and taking all the crayons and picking the colors and just coloring.
For sure. There's an interesting psychological study that we'll get to in talking about rewards, specifically to do with coloring with markers. That was a whole setup of the experiment. But yeah, if we can, of course, make it structured, but make practicing and improving its own reward, that's sort of the gist of what I have to say in the presentation and what I try to live by, not always perfectly in my own teaching. I guess a couple of the big goals first, and then takeaways where we want to get, and then a little bit of the social science to support it. You mentioned briefly earlier extrinsic, intrinsic motivation, and now might be a good time to pull up one of, I'll pull up a slide here.
Let me just jump in to remind the audience, if you're just listening, that we have it on YouTube as well, so you can see our lovely faces and any visuals. So Evan's got some slides here, and that is The Piano Sensei Way on YouTube. All right.
This slide, if you're able to see it, and if you're not, I'll read it out for you.
Yep.
Something just to keep in mind for a little bit later in our talk, as we get into the rewards and the potential undermining effect they can have on motivation. This was something that I heard in an intro to psych class in college that always stuck with me. And it is, if you want someone to like you, get them to do you a favor. Which sounds counterintuitive, right? If we want someone to like us, we should do them a favor and they'll think highly of us. But we'll come back to this a little bit later. I want to talk just a little bit about the kinds of motivation that we want to cultivate, and what is going to lead us to sort of a student-centered approach, and what's going to help them stay perpetually motivated. So this definition up on the screen now, a person's willingness to exert physical or mental effort in pursuit of a goal or outcome comes from the American Psychological Association. And that's just motivation broadly. So within motivation, what I think is most holistic is 1, mastery, which I'll explain in a moment, and 2, intrinsic. Okay, so when we're talking about mastery, going for your personal best, versus performance motivation, which is the competition with others is what gets you going. Okay. And then the intrinsic, which, you know, comes from within. It's enough to improve and do your personal best, similar to mastery in that way, versus extrinsic, which is incentive-based. Could be competition with others, could be rewards. There's a desire to please others. It could just be for praise from others, you know, from our parents, from our teachers, all of which can be very healthy, even rewards, certainly praise, you know, from parents and teachers and people whose opinions we respect. But mm-hmm. when we overdo it, or when we use it the wrong way, or when it becomes conditioned on some sort of outcome, it can be undermining. Sort of alongside this, executive function, ability to manipulate working memory, lots of psychological attributes or skills that people can develop and improve through certain techniques go hand in hand with intrinsic motivation in predicting better mental health, better physical health, better career outcomes in life. So when we're talking a little bit about executive control or executive function, Merriam-Webster, this definition up on the screen, that's what the MW stands for, a group of complex mental processes and cognitive abilities, such as working memory, impulse inhibition, and reasoning that control the skills required for goal-directed behavior. Those skills are organizing tasks, remembering details, managing time, solving problems. So like when we teach music, we pitch it, you know, and we don't have to be teaching a performance-oriented studio or students who are going to be particularly serious about music in the future. But these kinds of transferable skills that we pitch so often to students and more often their parents, I mean, this is what we're talking about, right? Mm-hmm. That students can study something like music in depth and they come away with it with what we might, you know, for lack of a better catch-all term, like self-mastery, right? Mm-hmm. Or this sort of ability to control your impulses, delay gratification, manage your time properly, solve problems, think critically. All of these things are, you know, you and I know that they can come from piano study or applied study of any discipline, but these intrinsic motivation, I mean, these are the things that we really want our students to take away, I think, no matter what they're going to do with music in the future. We know that they're going to be helpful mm-hmm. in whatever they do in life, right? When people are focused, they are happier. So research has shown that people who developed these skills, specifically impulse inhibition, earlier in life have better outcomes. There was a study, it was just called the marshmallow study. It's a classic psychology study where children were brought into a room with a researcher and they were shown, I forget if it was like three marshmallows on a plate. And they're told, you can eat these now, or the researcher would say, I'm going to go and come back. And if you wait for me to come back, you can get more marshmallows later.
Okay.
Right. So tough choice. But they logged the results and they tracked these children as they went through their lives over decades. And the children who had the impulse control to wait for more marshmallows had better outcomes across, you know, social, career, health, everything. Okay. So all of these mental processes that we develop through structured study and that, you know, the intellectual curiosity that comes with being intrinsically driven and centering our students in their studies of piano, all these sort of auxiliary skills pay dividends in so many different ways, not just academically, throughout their lives.
Yeah, that's interesting. And when you say when people are focused, they're happier, is that in general, like somebody who is more focused is a happier person? Or when I'm doing an activity where I'm focused, I'm happier right then? Or both?
More of the latter, okay. Although I think the implication is the former as well. Mm-hmm. Again, there was a study, I'm blanking exactly on how it was structured, but participants were in two groups doing a similar activity, and one of them had a clear objective or clear guidelines for, you know, do this with whatever the material was, or, mm-hmm. you know, the activity. And those people reported less boredom, more enjoyment in their task than those whose time was left a little bit less structured in the experiment. To get to sort of the crux of all of this, which is rewards and how we can use them and how we might try not to use them so much. So think back to that quote from earlier, right? If you want someone to like you, get them to do you a favor. And the concept behind this is cognitive dissonance, where there are two competing ideas that we hold in our brain at the same time, and we have to reconcile them. And we don't always reconcile them consciously, okay? So in that example, why should I do them a favor? I barely know this person.
Yeah.
Right. So I barely know this person. I just agreed to give them my time. I did them this favor. Why? Brain reconciles that and says, I guess I like them. I guess they're okay with me if I just, you know, went out of my way and did something out of the goodness of my heart and gave them my time and effort, right? So because I've done this person who I don't know so well a favor, I guess I like them.
If you want somebody to like you, get them to do you a favor. That stuck out to me. I remember when I first heard you talk about this over a year ago. That's like the main thing I remember. And it's just fascinating to me. And
for sure, it seems so counterintuitive.
Yeah. And I think I do that even with my students. You know, it can even just be really little. And I'm not trying to manipulate them, but, you know, they might come into the room and I'm at the computer and I'll be like, hey, good to see you. Hey, would you mind just shutting the door real quick? I mean, that's a favor. It's tiny.
Sure.
But just things like that. I do that. I ask them to do me favors all the time.
Well, yeah, and I don't think there's necessarily anything cynical or manipulative about it. If you are building cohesion within your studio, you know, getting different studio members to, you know, set the stage for studio class or, mm-hmm. you know, just chip in and do this or that. I mean, I was listening to another one of your episodes and you talked about board service for a local association, right? Yeah. You feel honored to do it, of course, but then, you know, you also feel like if you've given them your time when you could have been doing a whole bunch of other things, goodness knows, right? Mm-hmm. Your brain sort of backtracks and says, oh yeah, I like these people. I feel strongly about this organization. That's why I'm giving them my time, you know, in a volunteer capacity, right?
Right.
So it's not always, you know, it's certainly not a bad thing or a manipulative mm-hmm. thing. And I think effective leaders use this and people trying to build buy-in to organizations or studios or whatever. But it's a really interesting principle.
Yeah.
With rewards, there's this undermining effect that we risk. If we extrinsically incentivize practicing, for instance, or we are too driven toward competitions or results and festival or whatever, that external motivating factor, that reward, risks undermining intrinsic motivation going forward. So to back this up, I found some really interesting psychological studies. The one that's on the screen here, the Good Player Award, I believe, if I'm remembering correctly, the way this one was structured, participants were given a game that they were told to play for a fixed amount of time. And then in one group, they were just told to play for a while. In the other group, they were told play, and the highest ranking participant, or, you know, the most successful one of you is going to get what's called the Good Player Award. So those in the non-competitive group reported being happier playing the game and played the game for longer after the study concluded. They went back to just keep playing it for fun than those in the competitive group with the Good Player Award at stake. You mentioned coloring earlier. There was another study where children were given markers, and in one group, they were told color whatever you'd like, and in the other group, they were told that it was going to be sort of adjudicated. It was a contest. Those who were in the non-competitive group kept coloring after the study ended. Not only did they color for longer, not only did they color more pictures, but their drawings, their colorings, were deemed by the researchers to have greater artistic merit than those in the competitive group. So we see this undermining effect that rewards can have if we're not careful about them. So, you know, you think about getting a student to practice, right? If we have a target performance date or something in mind for them, and we've told them, you know, if you practice this week, you fill up your star chart, your sticker chart, and we get this or that trophy, or, you know, whatever the motivator is, we risk them not wanting to practice because of cognitive dissonance later on, because they are presented with the idea that on the one hand, practicing should be fun. My teacher tells me practicing should be fun all the time. And then on the other hand, they're bribing me to do it. Mm. So what does that mean? And the brain reconciles that as, well, maybe practicing's not fun. Maybe I don't want to practice, but I'm being rewarded for doing it because they really know deep down it's not fun. Right.
Yeah. Okay. That's very interesting. And it makes me wonder and think, because I've done some of those challenges before in my studio, you know,
sure. Like
100 day practice,
Of course.
100 day practice challenge and all these kinds of things. And yeah, I go back and forth because in some way I think, okay, yeah, maybe they will think it's a chore. I wouldn't want them to think it's a chore, but sometimes once they get on a roll of practicing and they get better, then they like it because they're getting better. And then they naturally do it more anyway after that.
For sure. That sounds like an effective use for a couple of reasons. One is that I think you're rewarding just doing it. It's mm-hmm. not necessarily there's a competition at the end of this. There's a performance at the end of this. It's just, we're just going to practice. Okay.
Okay. Yeah.
So you're rewarding
the effort.
You're getting them, yeah, effort, right? Irrespective of outcome. And the other part of it is, if especially something that I think I want to get back to talking about in Montessori, if this is something across a studio and it's a big group activity, they find camaraderie in it, I think, in a way that they're all working toward their own mastery, but they have friends who are doing it together. They can see, oh, you know, these students are going to spend this much time after school practicing. I might as well do it too. Rather than, you know, it's not, you're not talking about a competition who can practice the most gets a bigger reward. That might be a problematic way to use it, I think.
Okay. Yeah. Interesting.
Let's talk about deadlines. This is another just kind of reality of life. I mean, of anything. Mm-hmm. Things happen. Recitals happen on certain days. Grades are submitted on certain days, or, you know, whatever. Just events are scheduled. Things need to happen on a certain time frame. And to make that happen, we set deadlines. So again, psychological studies have borne out that participants working on what they perceive as a deadline, what they're told is a deadline, are less productive in the long term. They may have a short bump in productivity right before that deadline, but then there's a big lull afterward, like after that study has concluded. And I think we've all felt this a little bit, where we've crammed something for a deadline and then we've not gone back to it with the same intensity or the same regularity for a little mm-hmm. while, right? So we can't not have deadlines. I mean, they exist for a reason. You know, we do need students to get through technical elements, repertoire pieces. We do need ourselves to do things. You know, the recital needs to happen on a certain day. But how can we manage deadlines so that they're not, they don't have this demotivating kind of effect? But getting to deadlines in just a moment, I'm going to read a quote here from this slide from Dr. Montessori, talking about executive function, sort of self-mastery. She wrote, "No one can be free unless he is independent. In reality, he who is served is limited in his independence." Right? So this idea that autonomy and control over one's own actions and circumstances creates a sort of a more powerful learning experience and growth experience mm-hmm. than being told what to do or having all the parameters defined for you, what that needs to look like in the lesson, right? So questions, even if it's what time signature is this piece in, rather than just saying, okay, so we're in 4/4 time and that means this and that, what time signature are we in? What does that mm-hmm. mean for where the stresses are going to be? How would you conduct this? You know, any, even a very simple question is better than giving information. Right? And the benefits of this, we exercise the working memory and you simulate the thought processes involved in effective practicing. So if we show, if we model this enough for students, if we talk them through this whole process enough in the lesson, they start to think this way on their own when they see the music, when they practice. They start to ask themselves questions. To sum up a few of the ideas, autonomy and executive control, students need to feel that their input is valued, that they have some sort of control over what's happening in their practice and also in the lesson. So we'll look at specifics in a moment. Making improvement the goal, targeting rewards. Okay, like we talked about with the practice challenge, that'd be an appropriate use, I think, of incentives. Mm-hmm. Balancing routine and unpredictability, keeping things fun, sort of ties into some Montessori principles of this sort of open classroom where students go in any particular order, but you know, ideally they get through a number of very different types of work in a day or a week, but it's not so prescribed. It's at their own pace and it's the subject matter that they want to cover in the order they want to cover it. Learning happens at the student's own pace, which ties into deadlines a little bit as well. And let's look at a few ideas now. So in the music studio, how can we apply these ideas? In terms of getting students to feel independent and in control and to better exercise their executive function, which is going to help them be more intrinsically driven. Students write their own lesson notes. This, for me, started during COVID when I was doing only online lessons for a little while. And I was typing up this detailed Google Doc and sharing it with parents. And every week it was like, well, did you work from the Google Doc? Did your parents print it out? Oh, no, I forgot. Or, yeah, I looked at it. And mm-hmm. sometimes the follow through wasn't as strong as it could have been. It didn't seem like they're really invested in it. So I would tell them, okay, well, you know, find a notebook with a really cool cover that you like, and you're going to write your own notes. And they love that, especially, you know, you get third, fourth graders who are learning to write cursive, and they're really excited about that at that age. And just that process, again, making the process fun. And then it's like, well, I took the time to write this stuff down. What did I write? And maybe I should try it at the piano myself. So it improves mm-hmm. the quality of practice. Choice of repertoire items, choosing the order of a lesson. It's kind of controlled chaos, right? I'm not going to let my students play anything all the time. But even at the college level, like have a listen to these three Baroque works and choose one. And when they've chosen from mm-hmm. among my pre-approved selections, they're more invested in it. They feel like it was their choice, right? We've, of course, found something that they really like, but they also just take ownership in a different way. Order of lesson items up to the student. And this is something where I should put in a caveat that neurodivergent students, you know, specifically students on the spectrum, would have a very, very difficult time. And this is not something to mm-hmm. try with a student with autism. That can throw their whole lesson off to do things in a different order. For them, routine right. is very, very important, right? Determining practice duration and checklist. You know, again, controlled chaos, like how many times are you going to do this? You know, pick a number between 8 and 12 repetitions for this particular measure, left hand only. But just letting students determine some of those details themselves gives that feeling of autonomy and control. We already talked about questions in terms in the lesson rather than statements.
Yeah, that's great. And I want to comment on that just yeah. for a second. The choosing among the repertoire items. Yeah, I've been doing that forever. And I love that, just giving the student a choice. And I don't know, that just made sense to me. I've always done that.
Sure.
Yeah, I mean, you know, that seems new to some other people. Like, oh, how would you let them decide? And it's like, well, I have a couple ideas that I think would be good for them, right? And then they're just choosing,
right?
Do the A, B, or C.
Right. If you can pick one piece that has certain elements that you know are going to be good for a student, just find a couple other pieces, because, you know, maybe we think they would really like one piece, but we play it for them and they say, oh no, I want to play the other one. And even better, right. You know, if they're more interested in practicing it, that's great.
Yeah. And then talking about the choose your own adventure thing, mm-hmm. sometimes my students are surprised when they come in and maybe they start doodling something, you know, while I'm getting organized before I say, let me hear your scales or whatever it is. And then sometimes they're surprised that I'm interested in their doodling, you know? Mm. And so they might look at me sort of apologetic, like, oh, wait, or I guess we're supposed to start the lesson. But then, you know, I'll ask them, oh, that's fun. Where are you playing? Or where'd that come from? Or do more of that, right? And then that we just start doing that in the lesson, whatever it is. And that might become part of
plan. And I mean, that change of pace and just that possibility that when they come into their lesson, something like that could happen is reward enough. Like, that makes the process its own reward. It becomes fun to come to lessons. And if you're going to go to lessons, you should be practicing. And, you know, they remember some of that when they go home and they experience a little bit of that spontaneity and joy when they practice at home.
And then the last thing I want to say about this slide. Well, first of all, I always half jokingly say, you know, this is the Piano Sensei way. I call it the Piano Sensei way because my way is the best way. And so I like to have people on that agree with me. But no, actually, we had a debate on, we did a live stream on debate, like to count or not to count. So that's fun. But anyway, the other thing that is the Piano Sensei way is the power of the question. I love that. Mm-hmm. And I would encourage teachers, try this for one whole day, or if you can't handle that, maybe just one lesson. Try to make everything you say a question. And I did that once for all my students in one day. So it was like only like 6 or 7 students, but everything I'm going to say is a question. And it's really fun and it's really helpful.
Yeah, it's fun. I mean, there's no way a student can tune out what's happening in the lesson if they have to respond to questions the whole time.
Right. And everything,
even if they're easy questions.
Right. And it makes you think more, you know, as the teacher. So instead of saying, oh, you should have done this, or let's do this next, you know, it's what do you want to do next, or what should you do next? And then how was that? Would you like to do anything different? Okay, so what do you want to do? And everything is a question, and it's really fun.
No, for sure. And I mean, even objective questions, if there's some slight variety in the way that it could possibly be answered, you learn something about your students. You know, the whole point of this is that we're centering the student in how they are learning, and that is going to be an important part of what motivates them, that they feel in control, right? They have that autonomy. And when they respond in a way that we don't quite anticipate, we learn something about them, and the lesson takes a turn that it might not have if we had just dictated, even if it seems like an easy answer, right? So you're always just opening the door to something unexpected, and an opportunity to learn about your students. Mm-hmm. And I mean, the choose your own adventure thing, you can make that even more fun with something as simple, and many people probably do this, right? You roll a die or pick a scale popsicle stick out of the jar and see what it says on the end, or, you know, anything like this. The idea behind that being the lesson is becoming its own reward, right? The process is fun. You can replicate this at home. Why don't you roll dice and, like, determine the order of events in your own practice for the day? You have a checklist of got to get through theory, technique, repertoire, et cetera, et cetera. You know, make a game out of what you do first, or play rock, paper, scissors with mom at home, and winner gets to choose the first item in your practice. So that becomes its own reward. That becomes fun, completely independent of content or of achievement or anything like that. Yeah.
Right.
This next slide shows a little bit more about Montessori principles and what that might look like in the studio. I want to look very briefly, though, at work journals, which is where students log what they're doing in a Montessori classroom, what they've covered over the course of a week. And that not only do they have some say regarding what they study and when, the order of events, but that it can help creatively manage deadlines. So if you're having a student take their own lesson notes, you know, you can ask them, well, you know, what are your goals for the week? What are your goals for each day? You know, what's our metronome mark for this piece going to be by this date. And of course, we're the man behind the curtain, the person behind the curtain, right? We know sort of where things need to end up, and we're steering their decision-making towards something that's gonna resemble a hard deadline that will get them prepared for whatever event in time, as if we had given a deadline. But it won't have that demotivating effect afterward. They won't feel that letdown of, I crammed for this deadline and I made it and I played my piece, the recital, now I'm not gonna practice for a week.
So to avoid the negative effect of the deadline is to have them make their own deadline? Is that the gist
of
it?
In a way, yeah. Yeah. And it doesn't have to be, you don't have to tell them what date are you going to have this learned and memorized and up to tempo, you know? Although that would still be better than telling them you're going to have this learned and memorized and up to tempo by this date. But if you can work incrementally, keeping an eye on where they need to go in the long term with a piece or with a project, and get them coming up with their own incremental deadlines, I mean, that's, I think, the most helpful for them in the long term and in whatever endeavor, you know, being able to parse out, you know, this is how I need to manage my time effectively. This is sort of a good stopping point for the next couple of days on this. And, you know, this is where all this needs to be tracking if I'm going to have it ready on time.
Yeah, okay. So, for example, would it be helpful then to have a student or ask them, okay, so for next week's lesson, what do you think you are able to do? Or something like that? Or do you think you can learn the B section by next lesson or what? Something like that?
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I mean, what, you know, what metronome mark do you want to take these measures next time? Mm-hmm. Or, you know, which of these three sections do you think you want to memorize in the next week?
Mm-hmm. Okay, yeah.
These slides just show a side-by-side comparison of teacher-centered versus student-centered approaches. So teacher-centered, same order of events as we've discussed already, right? Student-centered would be a choose-your-own-adventure kind of approach where you could even gamify how you choose rock, paper, scissors or a coin flip or something. Mm-hmm. Teacher-centered, something as seemingly insignificant as telling a student how many repetitions, five times, they're going to do this measure versus choose your favorite number between 5 and 10. Did they know they had a favorite number between 5 and 10? I don't know. But maybe that seems more fun to them than just being told.
Right.
Something that also ties in this next one into Montessori philosophy a little bit. No, you can't hear. Your melody's not coming out enough. Your voicing's just not projecting. Like, don't you hear that? Try it again. Versus something that not only centers the student and opens their ears, but gets them off the bench and kind of changes their sight line for a little bit and just keeps things fresh would be, why don't you go sit in that comfy chair in the corner and close your eyes and listen to me play it a few different ways and see what you think about each one and what you like best about it. So going for things that are open-ended, that invite the student's input, that ask questions, that in this last case, get up and get them off the bench a little bit, take a little brain break, depending on lesson length and age. Okay.
Yeah, that's good. In my studio, we have two pianos side by side. And a lot of times I just get in the rut of like, I'm at this one and you're at that one. But I've noticed sometimes we just switch, you know, say, okay, now play it again, but on this piano. It's super exciting for them, even though, okay, they're just practicing it again, right?
Yeah, and it just kind of unlocks them, you know, from sitting in the same position at the same instrument, craning their neck the same way to look at their teacher for the whole lesson. And it just feels different. You know, they feel like the teacher for a minute or you know, it just is a little bit of freshness in the lesson that makes the lesson, again, makes the process its own reward. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, you know, we do need to sign students up for adjudicated events, for recitals, studio recitals, where they're hearing other students play. These have so many benefits for students. They do have the potential drawback of students practicing because they're going to be in competition with others, in comparison with others, or at least experiencing that in the moment. So how do we sort of make this all a little bit more holistic? Maybe tracking their own development over time, recording them on the same piece, okay, at intervals of a few weeks apart, or every week. And then, you know, this week, you seem a little bit down about your memorization or your left-hand evenness in this one section. I want you to go back and listen to our lesson from 3 weeks ago, or your run through this from 3 weeks ago, and just see what you notice. See if you think it sounds better, right? Rather than, I'm never going to be able to play this as fast as the star pupil. And that comparison with others versus working for mastery. So, you know, a lot of these are things that are just sound pedagogy or just seem instinctive that, you know, many of us just do anyway. Mm-hmm. But I think it's even more interesting to unpack some of the psychological research behind it and to understand why these things are good for students, you know, what it does for their developing sense of executive function over time and intrinsic drive and what it does to center them in the lesson, what they're going to take away from that, you know, what it's going to do for them at the piano and their motivation to practice, but long term.
Right. So yeah, all of this is really good with the motivation and how we can structure lessons and change it up and, you know, in order to help students be motivated. But how does it translate or help them actually be motivated to practice at home? Do you know what I mean? I mean, you mm-hmm. kind of touched on it already, but okay, so we do all these things in the lesson and then are they just more inclined to do it at home because they enjoy that whole process?
Well, I'm going to respond with a question in keeping with that whole thing. What are you trying to model in your lessons with students? You know, why do you do the things that you do in a lesson with students?
Well, the main reason or the main point is to help them know how to practice.
So not just we segment a piece this way, left hand, right hand, these measures, this many times, and then this, and then cumulative and build bigger and bigger sections. Mm-hmm. But everything that goes into a lesson, from the doodling to, you know, if they're practicing and they want to doodle Beethoven for 5 minutes and then come back to practice, or they want to roll dice and determine the order of their practice, or they want to create silly lyrics to something they're practicing, or, you know, it could be anything. I mean, I had students who finally got into a groove of good number of repetitions at home of seeing some good improvement on a couple pieces in particular. And I asked what was going on, and they were into Legos, and they would take Legos and build little strings of, you know, 10 Lego pieces in a row mm-hmm. with every correct repetition. So the way that this translates into practice is that we're, you know, when we teach, we're modeling what we want to happen in a practice session, right? Everything from asking questions, being curious rather than telling, right? So that they start to think that way themselves. What is the time signature? What are the implications of that, right? What key am I in? Is it major or minor? How do I know my circle of fifths real well? What chords can I expect to find in this key? And then, and on and on. And that's endless. And that's what sparks their curiosity going forward. So everything from asking questions to gamifying certain aspects of the lesson, you know, all of those things, if they're happening at home and if the student's enjoying it, which I think they would be in a lesson, makes for a much more fun practice session than just sort of, you know, I'm supposed to do this many times because my teacher said so. I hope I don't make mistakes.
Right. So then would you encourage parents, especially of younger children, to help with that? You know, they can be the one to
roll
the dice with them and, you know, do this.
Yeah. And I mean, this is, again, these are things that transfer beyond playing the piano, but mm-hmm. you know, when you have a parent who, and Suzuki philosophy covers all of this, I'm not saying anything new here, but a parent who understands, first of all, how hard it is with their kids having to do, but also is tasked not with sitting there and, you know, slapping the ruler, but like making it fun and getting the kid into it, that does a lot for their relationship and what, you know, how the kid grows up and how the parent is going to support and not be conditionally praising them based on a competition outcome or something like that. I mean, I feel, you know, with my private students, I've always recommended/required of students under, you know, pick an age, 8, 9, must have a parent practicing with them. You know, very few under that age are, you know, cognizant enough of what they're doing. And that's okay. That's normal. Some students like to have their parents with them until they're, you know, preteens or whatever, for a while longer. But yeah, as fun as a parent can make it at home, simulate those parts of the lesson that are really fun. And then when the student is enjoying the lesson that much, they want to come back to their lessons. And as I said, they sort of feel a little bit of that. They take that home with them. And when they practice, they remember how fun it was that, you know, Sensei Clinton looked at my doodle and we started with that instead of my scales, you know, and that makes their practicing fun when they think back on that.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, that's good. It's all really helpful. I guess we're about to wrap up. If you have any final thoughts and or if you want to tell people where they can find out more about you, if you have a website or anything.
Oh,
it was the time.
Yeah, thank you. My website is my name, evanmitchell.net. I try to keep up with all the social medias. I'm on Instagram and on Facebook. Instagram is evan.mitchell.pianist. Usually all that stuff cross posts to my Facebook, personal page. Yeah, should be pretty responsive if folks hear this and have questions and want to reach out. Be more than happy to talk about it some more.
Yeah, great. All right. Well, thanks again, Evan. It's been really helpful. And just a reminder to everyone, you can subscribe to get notifications of when new episodes come out, thepianosenseiway.com. And on YouTube is also The Piano Sensei Way. Thanks, everyone. Take care. And thank you, Evan.
Thank you.